Chapter 4. Anathpaneia. Like a stern father, war shames men into hating their childhood games. Protathus, 100 heavens. I returned from that campaign a far different man, or so my mother continuously complained. Now only the dead, she would tell me, can hope to match your gaze. Triamus the First, Journals and Dialogues. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Momum. Perhaps Icures Arius III mused, tonight would be a night of desserts. From the vantage of the imperial apartments on the Andiamine Heights, the Menenor seemed a vast, shining plate beneath the moon. Zorias could scarce remember ever seeing the great sea so preternaturally calm. He considered summoning Erythmaeus, his augur, but decided against it, more out of hubris than generosity. The man was a fawning charlatan. They all were. As his mother would say, every man was a spy in the end, an agent of contrary interests. Every face was made of fingers, like Scaeus. Despite the vertigo, he leaned against the balustrade, staring, clutching tight a mantle of fine-brushed galeoth wool against the chill. As always, his eyes were drawn southward, to the dark sockets of the coast. Shima lay out there, and Confis. It seemed perverse somehow that men might plot and strive so far beyond his capacity to see or know. Perverse and terrifying. He heard the approach of sandaled feet behind him. God of men, his new exalt captain, Scala, said in a hushed voice. The Empress wishes to speak with you. Zorias exhaled, surprised to find he'd been holding his breath. He turned, looked up into the towering Sepulorian's face, which seemed ugly or handsome by turns of shadow or light. His blonde hair tumbled about his shoulders, crimped into tails with silver bands, a sign of some fierce tribe or other. Scala wasn't the most pleasing ornament, but he'd proven an able replacement ever since Gain Kelty's death, ever since that mad night with the Mandate Sorcerer. Show her in. He drained his bowl of Amplian Red. Seized by a sudden recklessness, he cast it at the southern horizon, as though daring the distances to be anything other than what they appeared. Why shouldn't he be suspicious? The philosopher said this world was smoke, after all. He was the fire. He watched the golden ball pirouette out, then sink into the obscurity of the lower palace. The faint ring and clatter brought a smile to his lips. He felt such contempt for things. Scala, he called to the withdrawing man.
Yes, God of men.
Some slave will steal it, that bowl.
Indeed, God of men.
Zorias belched, though with decorum. Whoever it is, have him flogged. Expressionless, Scala nodded, then turned to the golden interior of the imperial apartments. Zorias followed, struggling not to reel. He directed the flanking Eothic guardsmen to close the folding doors and draw the drapes behind him. There was nothing to see out there, save calm seas and endless stars. Nothing. He lingered over the flames of the nearest tripod, warming his fingers. Already his mother was ascending the steps from the lower suites, and he found himself clenching his thumbs, trying to purge the slop from his thoughts. Only wit, Zorias had learned long ago, could preserve him from Icuri Istria. Peering over stair and past tapestried wall, he glimpsed her giant eunuch, Bizathalus, looming over his guardsmen in the antechamber. Not for the first time he found himself wondering whether she ever fucked the oiled whale. He should be wondering at her motives, he knew, but she had seemed so predictable of late. And besides, the mood had come upon him. Had she but pestered him moments later, he was sure he would have been indisposed. She did look beautiful for an old hag. A headdress of wings worked in mother-of-pearl adorned her dyed hair, with a veil of tiny silver chains hanging just past her painted brows. Bound tight against her figure with golden ribbon, her gown was both simple and traditional, though the printed blue silk he imagined had cost him a war galley. He knew he needed to blink the wine from his eyes, but she seemed more supple than wiry. How long had it been?
God of men,
she said, cresting the last step. She lowered her head in perfect genanic form. For a moment, Soraya stood speechless, quite disarmed by this uncharacteristic display of respect.
Mother, he said carefully.
When a vicious dog nuzzled one's hand, it meant it was hungry, very hungry.
The Sake have been here to see you.
Thasius, yes. He must have passed you on his way out.
Not Kemen Ketri?
Zariah snorted.
What is it, Mother?
You've heard something, she said stridently. Confess has sent a message.
Bah!
He smacked his lips, turning from her. Bitch, always yelping over her bowl.
I raised him, Zarius. He was my ward, far more than he was ever yours. I deserve to know what happens. I deserve.
Zarius paused, keeping her figure in his periphery. It was strange, he thought, the way the same words could infuriate him at one moment, yet strike a tender chord at another. But that was what it all came down to in the end, wasn't it? His whims. He looked her full in the face, struck by how luminous, how young her eyes seemed in the lantern light. He liked this whim.
They know, he said. This imposter, this warrior prophet, or whatever they're calling him, accused Confess, accused me of plotting to betray the Holy War. Can you imagine?
For some reason, she seemed unsurprised. It occurred to Zarius that she could be the one who had betrayed their plans. Why not? Hers was an unnatural commingling of the masculine and the feminine intellect, driven by both an excessive need for approval and an equally excessive obsession with security. As a result, she saw rashness and cowardice everywhere she looked, in her son most of all.
What has happened?
She asked, her tone lilting in concern.
Oh, yes. One mustn't forget her precious nephew's skin. Confess has been turned out. He and what remains of his columns are to be interned at Jokhtha to await transport back to the Nansorium.
Good, she said, nodding. So your madness ends.
Zarius laughed.
My madness, Mother?
He graced her with a smile all the more cutting for its genuineness.
Or Confess's?
The Empress sneered.
And what's that supposed to mean, my dear son?
The ravages of age. He had watched it happen to his father's contemporaries, watched their skulls scraped as hollow as clamshells until their decrepit bodies seemed positively virile compared with their addled souls.
Zarius found himself suppressing a shudder.
These games of word and wit, they were her legacy. When had she fallen so many steps behind? And yet, it means, Mother, that Confess has the field. He shrugged amiably. I haven't recalled him.
What are you saying, Zarius? They know now, know what you intend. It would be madness.
He stared at her, wondering how she managed it after so many years.
Indeed. I'm sure the great names think much the same.
How could a crone look so virginal? She closed her long-lashed eyes, smirking in her coquettish way. For once, it didn't seem a vain travesty.
I see,
she said, sighing in the manner of a world-weary lover. Even still, after all this time, he could remember her hand that first night, like ice stroking his baffled fire. That first night. Sweet Sejanus, but he was hard, so pulsing hard. He set down his bowl and turned to her. Suddenly he found himself pressing her back toward his canopied bed. She didn't melt into compliance beneath his clasp like a slave might, but neither did she resist. She smelled young. Tonight would be a night of desserts. Please, Mother, he heard himself murmuring. It's been so long. I've been so lonely. Only you, Mother, only you understand. He laid her across the great black sun embroidered into his coverings. His hands trembled as he fussed with her gowns. His groin throbbed so sweetly he feared he might soil his robes.
You do love me, he gasped. You do love.
Her painted eyes had become drowsy, delirious. Her flat chest heaved beneath the fabric. Somehow he could see through the skein of wrinkles that made a mask of her face, down to the serpentine truth of her beauty. Somehow he could see the woman who had driven his father mad with jealousy, who had shown her son the ecstasy of secrets bundled between sheets.
My sweet son,
she gasped.
My sweet.
His fingers and palm found warm skin. His heart became a thunderclap. He ran his hand along her calves, which she shaved in the fashion of the Ainani, then across her still smooth thighs.
Could it be?
He clutched at her groin, squeezed the haft of her erection. There was no air for shouting. He toppled back across the floor and worked his mouth soundlessly, and she stood and smoothed her gowns, and he scrambled backward, somehow managing to scream for his guards. The first to arrive were too dumbfounded to do much more than die. A face imploded, a throat torn and gushing. It all seemed so ridiculous. Pizathalus, her giant eunuch, tried to restrain her, bawling out in some incomprehensible tongue. She broke his neck as easily as twisting a melon on the vine. Then she had a sword. She seemed a spider, her two limbs becoming eight with flashing grace. She danced and twirled. Men crumpled and cried out. Boots skidded across blood. Blue tattooed limbs slapped against the floor, bruising dead bone. Zarius turned, scrambling toward the door. There was no fear. That required comprehension, only an all-encompassing urgency, a primal need to remove himself from such sights, such circumstances. He fought his way past two guardsmen. His limbs floated. He ran shrieking down the gilded corridor. Slippers! Slippers! How could anyone run in fucking slippers? Steaming censers whipped past him, but he could smell only the rank of his own bowel. How his mother would cackle, her boy shitting his imperial regalia. Run! Run! Somewhere he could hear Scala bawling commands. He vaulted downstairs only to tumble, thrashing like a dog sewn into a sack. Moaning, blubbering, he found his feet, lurched back into a run. What happened? Where were his guardsmen? Tapestries and gilded panels swam about him. There was shit on his knuckles. Then something bore him face first into the marmoreal tiles. A shadow upon his back, a dozen hyenas laughing through its throat. Iron hands about his face, nails scoring his cheek, a meaty pop in his neck. An impossible glimpse of her. Mother. Blood spattered and disheveled. There was no... Early spring, 4112, year of the Tusk, Sumna. Saul looked up, blinking and scowling. How early was it?
Come, come,
Hertata cried from the mouth of the alley.
Maithanet comes. They say Maithanet comes to the Stone Keys.
There was something in Hertata's eyes when he said this, a hope or a longing that had grown too great. Though Saul was only 11, he saw this, even without words, to comprehend it.
But the slavers?
The slavers were always a worry, especially at the Stone Keys where they held their markets. For slavers, finding a young orphan was like finding a coin dropped in the street.
They wouldn't dare, not with Maithanet coming. They would be damned.
Hertata always said things twice, even though the others so harshly teased him for it. They called him Hertata Tata, or, more cruel still, Echo. Hertata was strange.
It's Maithanet, Saul.
There were tears in his eyes.
They say he's leaving, that he's sailing across the sea. But the winds started this morn. They've come, and now he's sailing across the sea, across the sea.
Why should he care for Maithanet? Men with gold rings gave no copper, unless they wanted to stick them. Why should he care for Maithanet, who would just try to stick him if he could? Fucking priests, anyway. But the tears in Hertata's eyes? Saul could see he was afraid to go alone. Groaning, Saul stood and kicked about his rag bedding. He tried his best to sneer at Hertata's beaming face. He'd seen Hertata's ilk before,
always whimpering mommy in the middle of the night, always crying, always getting sticked for food because he was too afraid to steal. They never survived, none of them, just like his little brother. But not Saul. His feet were rabbit quick. Not far from their alley lay a large foolery, and they stopped to piss in the giant bowls arrayed before it. The facade was always crowded, especially in the morning. They did their best to avoid looking at the beggars with fuller's feet, the rot that resulted from years of mashing laundry, though they could hear their curses and catcalls. Even cripples despised those poorer than themselves. Finishing, the boys cut across the sulphurous reek of the fuller's yard, laughing at the rows of men stomping up and down in cement basins arranged in batteries. The air fairly thundered with the slap of wet fabric across the drying stones. They darted past the drovers who crowded the far entranceway with their donkeys and laundry carts.
"Will there be food?"
Saul asked her tata.
"Petals," the younger boy assured him. "They always throw petals when the Shrier walks."
"I said food,"
Saul snapped, even though he knew he would eat petals if he could. The boy's brown eyes remained fixed on his feet. He had no idea.
"It's him, Saul. Maithanet."
Saul shook his head in disgust. Fucking her tata tata. Fucking echo. They passed through the more affluent porticoed streets immediately adjacent to the Hagurna. Vendors opened their shops, joking with their slaves as they drew heavy wooden shutters from grooves in the burnt brick thresholds. Periodically, the two boys glimpsed the great monuments of the holy precincts between the posh tenements fencing the sky. Every glimpse of the Junrayuma's turrets set them to pointing and whistling with wonder. Even orphans could hope. They dared not enter the Hagurna itself, for fear of the Shrial Knights, so they followed the surrounding streets toward the harbor. For a time, they walked along the wall itself, gawking at its immensity. Vines sheeted most of it in leafy green, and they took turns guessing what the other thought the patches of bare and ancient stone most resembled, rabbits, owls, or dogs. In the Parampus market, they overheard two women say that Maithanet's ship was berthed in the Zatansian Basin, the hexagonal harbor some old emperor had excavated from the shores of Sumna's natural harbor long, long ago. They made their way to the warehouse district, amazed that even as far out as the Millery Street, the way was crowded with people walking in the same direction. They paused to savor the smell of fresh bread and to chortle at the mules they could see in the shadowy interiors all about them, plodding round and round their millstones. The air had taken on a carnival atmosphere, rumbling with laughter and animated discussion, punctuated by the squeal of children and the bawling of infants. Despite himself, Saul scowled less and less at Hurtada's ridiculous comments. He even laughed at the boy's jokes. Though he would never admit it, Saul was happy he had listened to Hurtada. Being surrounded by glad-hearted people all walking the same direction made him feel as though he belonged to something, as if through some inarticulate miracle he had found his way back inside from the filth and cold and contempt. How long had it been since his father's murder? A band of musicians joined their impromptu migration, and Saul and Hurtada danced their way past the storehouses with their ramped entrances and slitted windows. They paused in the shadow of the great warehouse, which Hurtada had never seen, and Saul explained how his dear friend, the Emperor Icuri Zarius III, used it to hoard grain for him against times of famine. Hurtada howled with laughter. With the crowds thickening about them, they decided to run so they might beat the crush. As quick as he was, Saul took the lead, and Hurtada chased him, laughing. They darted about families, dodged along the narrow ways that drifted and twined through crowds of people. Saul allowed Hurtada to almost catch him twice, and the boys squealed in a way that made Saul both cringe and laugh. Finally, he let Hurtada tackle him. They wrestled for a moment, cursed each other with mock insults. After easily pinning him, Saul pulled Hurtada to his feet. They were close to the harbor now. Gulls screeched through the sky above them. The air smelled of water and swollen wood. They wandered about, suddenly anxious. Walking vendors, old harbormen mostly, were selling halved oranges to mask the stink, and the boys were lucky enough to find a few discarded rinds, which they gobbled, savoring the bitter.
I told you, Hurtado said, chewing. There was food.
Saul closed his eyes and smiled. Yes, Hurtado had spoken true. Without warning, the sonorous peal of the summoning horns rang across the city, at once so familiar and strangely threatening, as though a besieging army signaled its assault.
Come, come,
Hurtado cried. He grabbed Saul by the hand, began pulling him deeper into the milling crowds. Saul frowned. Only babies and stickers held hands. But he let the boy lead him through the labyrinth of waists and elbows nonetheless. He found himself studying Hurtado, who continually looked back, smiling with manic encouragement. From where had his sudden courage come? Everyone knew Hurtado was a cringer, yet here he was, barging toward an almost certain beating. Why would he risk such a thing? For Mathanet? As far as Saul was concerned, nothing was worth getting a beating, or even worse, getting clapped by slavers. He would sooner be sticked. And yet there was something in the air, something that made Saul feel uncertain in a way he had never felt uncertain before. Something that made him feel small, not in the way of orphans or beggars or children, but in a good way, in the way of souls. He could remember his mother praying the night his father had died, crying and praying. Was that what drove Hurtado? Could he remember his mother praying? They pressed through limbs and curses, and despite several swats, suddenly found themselves staring about the armored flanks of a shrial knight. Saul had never been so close to a knight of the tusk before, and he fairly trembled with dread. The white of the man's surcoat was so clean, the gold embroidery so brilliant. He wore a hauberk of silvered mail, beneath which he seemed impossibly solid, rooted like a tree. Like most boys he knew, Saul feared warlike men as much as he envied them. But Hurtado seemed entirely unimpressed. He poked his head past the knight as though staring around a stone column. Plucking up his courage, Saul followed Hurtada's lead and leaned forward to look up and down the street. Hundreds of shrial knights held the gathering masses in check. Others on horseback rode slowly along their lines, scanning the crowds as though expecting unwanted relatives. He was about to ask Hurtado if he could see any sign of the Shrya when, without a word, the knight gently pressed the two of them back into the midst of the other onlookers. Hurtado chatted endlessly about all the things his mother had told him about Mathanet, how he had cleansed the thousand temples, how he had smashed the heathen with his holy war, how he slept on a mat beneath the tusk-tusk, how the god himself blessed his every word-word, his every glance-glance, and his every footfall-fall.
He need only see me, Saul. He need only look. And then what?
But Hurtado would not say. Suddenly, they were hooting and cheering. They had both turned to the sound of a distant roar, striated with faint cries of,
Mathanet!
Then, for no reason Saul could fathom, they were roaring themselves. Hurtado actually bounced up and down. That is, until the crowds pressed them forward into the shrial knight, who had locked arms with his holy brothers to either side. The cacophony seemed to go on, and for a time, Saul feared his heart might burst for excitement.
The shrial was coming.
Never had he stood so close to the outside. The shouts waxed on, slowly leached of their fervor by fatigue. Then, just as Saul decided all their commotion was stupid, who cheered the invisible? He glimpsed sunlight flashing across jeweled rings. The shrial procession. His heart hammered in his chest. The sun seemed to spin in the sky above. Though breathless, he cried out, and it seemed his lungs, his mouth, his voice were innumerable. Three lavishly garbed priests crossed the narrow slot of their view. Then he stepped into sight. Younger, taller, paler, a full beard, wearing only a simple vestment, so white it pained the eyes to look. A thousand pleading hands reached out toward him, to greet, to implore, to touch. Hurtado was fairly shrieking, trying to gain his majestic attention. He merely walked, but but it seemed he moved so fast, as though the ground itself pulled him forward. For some reason, Saul raised his hands and reached out, not to touch the luminous image before him, but to jab his fingers at his friend, to point at the one soul that needed to be seen more than any other. Perhaps it was that Saul alone, of all those lining the avenue, gestured to another. Perhaps it was that Mathanet somehow knew. Whatever the reason, the bright eyes flickered toward him. Saw. It was the first total moment in his entire life. Perhaps the only. As Saul watched, Mathanet's eyes were drawn by his pointing fingers to Hurtada, wailing and jumping beside him. The Shrya of the Thousand Temples smiled. For a breathless moment he held the boy's gaze. Then the knight's form swallowed his hallowed image.
Yes!
Hurtada howled, fairly weeping with disbelief.
Yes, yes!
Saul clutched his hand and laughed. Still cheering, they both turned to a shadow. From nowhere, it seemed, a man loomed above and against them. His beard was full and square, which meant he was a foreigner. He stank of people. More ominous still, he stank of ships. He held a halved orange in his right hand, and the back of Hurtada's filthy tunic bunched in his left.
Where are your parents?
He boomed with predatory good nature. They had to ask that now. Whenever a real child disappeared, they always searched the slavers first. Slavers were hanged for stealing real children, just like the stickers were hanged for sticking them.
Oh, over there, there!
Hurtada whimpered, holding out a tentative finger. Saul could smell his piss.
You say?
The man laughed. But Saul was already running, past the knights and into the crowds on the far side of the procession. He was Saul. He was fleet. Afterward, huddling between stacked amphorae, he wept, always throwing a cautious eye to be sure no one could see. He spat and spat, but the taste of orange peel would not go away. Finally, he prayed. In his soul's eye, he glimpsed the flash of sunlight across jeweled rings. Yes, Hurtada had spoken true. Mathanet was sailing across the sea. Early spring, 4112, year of the Tusk, Anathpania. They were few. Only some 40,000 of them remained, but in their breasts beat the hearts of many. Beneath the slapping banners of Household, Tusk, and Circumfix, the holy war departed from mighty Karaskand and left behind a city scarcely inhabited. There had been much furor in the councils at Sauban's decision to remain behind. The other great names petitioned the warrior prophet to at least demand that Sauban allow his subordinates to march if they so desired. Many did so of their own accord anyway, including the tempestuous Athgieri. In the end, only some 2,000 Galioth would remain behind with their king and his empty city. They said that Sauban wept as the warrior prophet rode from the Gate of Horns. A far different holy war climbed the ways into the Anathpanian countryside. The newcomers, decked in the traditional tabards and surcoats of their homelands, provided the most stark measure of this transformation. Word of the holy war's straits in Karaskand had inspired several thousand in Rethi to dare winter seas and make for Jaktha. They began arriving at the gates shortly after the breaking of the siege, posturing, boasting, just as those watching upon the walls had once postured and boasted beneath the gates of Momum and Asgiliac. They fell silent, however, upon entering the city, appalled by the battered faces and perpetual stares that greeted them. The ancient customs were observed, hands were shaken, countrymen embraced, but it was all a pretense. The original men of the Tusk, the survivors, were now sons of a different nation. They had spilled whatever blood they once shared with these men. The old loyalties and traditions had become tales of a faraway country, like Zeum, a place too distant to be confirmed. The hooks of the old ways, the old concerns, had been set in fat that no longer existed. Everything they had known had been tested and found wanting. Their vanity, their envy, their hubris, all the careless bigotries of their prior lives had been murdered with their fellows. Their hopes had been burned to ashes. Their scruples had been boiled to bone and tendon, or so it seemed. Out of calamity, They had salvaged only the barest necessities. All else had been jettisoned. Their spare manner, their guarded speech, their disinterested contempt for excess, all spoke to a dangerous thrift. And nowhere was this more evident than in their eyes. They stared with the blank wariness of men who never slept, not peering, not watching, but observing, and with a directness that transcended bold or rude. They stared as though nothing stared back, as though all were objects. Among the newcomers, even the costumed caste nobles seemed unable or unwilling to match their gaze. Many tried to maintain appearances, the wry glances, the nods of acknowledgement, but their looks always returned to their boots or sandals. To stand in the sight of such men, they somehow understood, was to be measured, not by something as flawed and as arbitrary as a man, but by the length and breadth of what they had suffered. Their very look had become judgment, so much had they witnessed. Thoroughly unnerved by their so-called brothers, only a few hundred newcomers dared question the Holy War's other profound transformation, the warrior prophet. Those of power and influence, such as Dogora Teor, the Tidoni Earl of Sumagalt, were eased into the tribe of truth by the warrior prophet himself. Others found themselves befriended by judges from their various homelands, who spirited them to sermons and whelmings. Those who continued dissenting were separated from their fellows and assigned to companies of faithful. And the worst agitators, it was said, were brought before the consort, never to be seen again. The Enrithi found in Athpania abandoned by the enemy. Gothjelk, who marched along the coastline with his Tidoni, encountered the burned ruins of nearly 100 villas. Though most of the native Anathi, a people of ancient Shigeki stock, remained shut in their villages, not one of their Kianine lords could be found. No heathen patrols loitered in the distances. No dwelling of scale survived intact. When Athgieri and his Gainri came to the ends of Anathpania, the old forts that guarded the tracks into Zerash were still smoking, but the enemy was nowhere to be seen. The heathen's back had been broken, just as the warrior prophet had said. Save a triumphal march, it seemed nothing stood between them and Holy Shima. The first elements of the Holy War descended into Zerash and camped across the plains of Heshor, where they held a great celebration. Zerash figured large in the narratives of the tractate, so much so that many argued they had already entered the sacred lands. Men gathered to listen to readings from the Book of Traders, the account of the latter prophet's years of exile among the depraved Zerashi. It seemed a thing of awe to at last stand so close to those places named. But names change over the centuries, and many spent long hours debating points of scripture and geography. Was not the town of Ben-Gut actually the city of Abet-Goka, where Omoti merchants concealed the latter prophet from the wrath of the Zerashi king? Were not the massive ruins reported near Pedast the remains of the great fortress of Abaliol, where Inri Sejanus was imprisoned for prophesying the thousand temples? Throughout the following days, impromptu pilgrimages set out from the main columns to visit various sites. And even though the pilgrims were invariably disappointed by the stubborn silence of the ruins they found, the eyes of most would burn with fervor when they returned, for they walked the ways of Zerash. At Abaliol, the warrior prophet climbed the broken foundations and addressed thousands.
I stand, he cried, where my brother stood.
22 men died in the delirious crush. It would prove an omen of what was to follow. For millennia, the so-called Middle Lands had been coveted by the kings of Shigek to the north and the kings of Old Nilnamesh to the south. After inflicting a crushing defeat on the Shigeki, Anzumarapata II, the Nilnameshi king of Invishi, settled the plains of Heshor with untold thousands of his people, hoping to secure his empire through forced resettlement. These dark-skinned people brought with them their indolent gods and their promiscuous customs. They raised Garotha, the greatest city of Zerash, in the heart of the plains, and bent their backs to the fields as they had done in humid Nilnamesh. By the latter prophet's time, Zarash was an old and powerful kingdom, demanding and receiving tribute from both Amotu and Anathpenea. The Amati in particular thought the Zarashi an obscene race, a blight upon the land. For the authors of the tractate, it was a land of innumerable brothels, fratricidal kings, and rampant homosexuality. And though the blood and custom of the Nilnameshi had been thinned into extinction long ago, for the men of the Tusk, Zaratic still meant sodomite, and they punished the Phanum of Zarash for the trespasses of others long dead. The Zarash that the Enrithi wandered through was a place of old and labyrinthine evils, and her people found themselves called to account not once, but twice. Reports of massacre became common. There was the great fortress of Kijiniko along the coast, where Earl Iyengar had his Nangales throw the garrison from the walls onto the breakers below, and the walled town of Naeth, high in the Betmula foothills, which Earl Ganbrota and his Ingrawlish burned to the ground. There were the refugees along the Herotic Way, the very road to Shima, who were ridden down for sport by Lord Soter and his Kishyati knights. The warrior prophet reacted quickly, dispatching edicts forbidding all acts of murder and rapine, and censuring those responsible for the most wanton atrocities. He even sent Gotian to have Lord Uranyanka, the Einani Palatine of Mozorothu, flogged. Apparently the man had ordered his archers to massacre an enclave of lepers near the town of Sabotha. But it was too late. Athgieri soon returned, bearing word that Garotha had scorched her fields and plantations. The Kianin had fled, but all Zarash was closed against them. Despite the dread implications, despite all the astonishing differences, the journey to Zarash reminded Akamian of nothing so much as his days as Proyas's tutor in Aeoknissus, or so he told himself at first. On one occasion, after Esmenet's palfrey was lamed while descending a precarious switchback trail in the Anathpenean hills, Akamian watched as some dozen knights offered to give her their chargers, something tantamount to giving her their honor, since their mounts were their means of waging war. Akamian had witnessed much the same while accompanying Proyas and his mother to her dowager estates in Anpli. On another occasion, they encountered a party of Tidoni footmen, some of Lord Iyengar's Nangales, it turned out, bearing a fresh boar, hoisted above them on the points of some 7 or 8 spears, an ancient rite of vassalage that Akamian had once witnessed in the court of Proyas's father, Eucernus II. But there was something more general, a myriad of smaller recognitions that seemed to remind him of those more youthful days, despite the daily battery of riding so near Esmenet. For one, others in the sacral retinue treated him with deference and respect, their manner so grave it sometimes verged on the comic. He was, after all, the teacher of the warrior prophet, an occupation that had quickly morphed into the preposterous honorific holy tutor. For another, he no longer walked. Even more than slaves, horses were the yardstick of nobility, and Akamian, lowly Drusus Akamian, now found himself with his own, a sleek black, allegedly from Cascamandri's own stock, whom he called Noon, in memory of poor old Daybreak. In fact, he found himself awash in small riches, damask tunics, muslin gowns, felt robes, a wardrobe that included access to a pool of body slaves for his frequent ceremonial fittings, a silvered corselet restitched with leather pleats to accommodate his girth, an ivory jewel box containing rings and earrings that he felt too foolish to wear, as well as 2 black pearl brooches that he secretly gave away. Ambergis from Zeum, myrrh from the Great Salt, even a genuine bed, a bed on the trail, for those few hours of sleep he could steal. Akamian had disdained such comforts during his tenure at the Kunrayan court. After all, he was a Gnostic schoolman, not some anagogic whore. But now, after the innumerable deprivations he'd endured, the life of a spy was hard. To finally have things, even things he couldn't bring himself to enjoy, eased his heart for some reason, as though they were balm for unseen wounds. Sometimes when he ran his hands over soft fabric, or yet again searched through the rings for one he might wear, A clutching sadness would come upon him, and he would remember how his father had cursed those who carved toys for their sons. And there were the politics, of course, though they were largely confined to the genanic posturing of the caste nobles who continually drifted in and out of the sacral retinue. All maneuvering, no matter what its stripe, would instantly collapse into uniform servility whenever Kellis appeared, and just as quickly leap back into effect when he departed. Occasionally, when something particularly sour seemed to be brewing, Kellis would call the principals to account, and everyone would watch with rigid wonder as he explained things, people he could not possibly know. It was as though the writ of their hearts had been inked across their faces. This, no doubt, explained the near total absence of politicking among those who formed the core of the sacral retinue. The Nesenti, with their Zaudunyani functionaries, and the liaisons, the caste noble representatives of the different great names. In Aeocnesis, the closer one came to Proyas's father, the quicker the knives had flashed, as one might expect. Politics, after all, was the pursuit of advantage within communities of men. One need not be a gensis to see this. The more powerful the community, the greater the advantage. The greater the advantage, the more vicious the pursuit. It was axiomatic, something Akamian had witnessed time and again in courts across the Three Seas. And yet, it in no way applied to the sacral retinue. All knives were sheathed in the warrior prophet's hallowed presence. Among the Nesenti, Akamian found a camaraderie and a candor unlike anything he'd known before. Despite the inevitable lapses, they largely approached one another as men should, with humor, openness, understanding. For Akamian, the fact that they were as much warriors as apostles or apparati made it all the more remarkable and troubling. Usually, as they rode in clots or files, they would joke and argue, or make wagers, endless wagers. Sometimes they simply sang the gorgeous hymns Kellis had taught them, their eyes bright, devoid of oily thought or inclination, their voices clear and booming. And Akamian, though embarrassed at first, soon found himself joining them, wonderstruck by the words, the phrasing, and suffused with a joy that would seem impossible afterward, too simple, too profound. Then he would glimpse Esmanette rocking in her saddle amid her servants, or he would see another corpse, mute in the surrounding grasses, and he would recall the purpose of their journey. They rode to war, to kill, to conquer Holy Shima. In these moments, the differences between his present circumstance and his time as Proyas's tutor would loom stark before him, and the fleecy sense of reminiscence that seemed to permeate everything would grow hard with cold and dread. What was it he remembered? Several days into the march, as the holy war wound through one of the endless ravines that scored the Anathpenean countryside, a group of long-haired tribesmen, Surdu, Akamian would later learn, were brought to Kellis under the sign of the Tusk. For centuries, they said, they had preserved their Enrithi heritage, and now they wished to pay obeisance to those who had come to deliver them. They would be the eyes of the Holy War if they could, showing the men of the Tusk secret ways through the low ranges of the Betmula. Akamian missed most of what followed for the crowds, but he was able to see the Surdu chieftain curl over his knees on the earth while offering up an iron sword that had been bent into a V. Inexplicably, Kellis ordered the tribesmen seized. They were subsequently tortured, whereupon it was discovered that Kaskamandri's son, Fenial, had sent them. Apparently, he had seized his father's title and was even now assembling what dregs he could at Shima. The Surdu were indeed Enrithi, but Fenial had abducted their wives and children to compel them to lead the holy war astray. The new Padiraja, it seemed, was desperate for time. Kellis had them flayed alive, publicly. The image of the chieftain kneeling with the bent sword nagged Akamian for the remainder of the day. Once again, he was certain he'd witnessed something remarkably similar, but not in Kunraya. It couldn't be. The sword he remembered had been bronze. Then, in a rush, he understood. What he thought he recalled, what had suffused fairly everything with a ghostly air of familiarity, had nothing to do with his years as Proyas's tutor in the Kunrayan court. In fact, it had nothing to do with him at all. It was ancient Kunayuri, he remembered, the time Seswatha spent campaigning with that other Anasarimber, High King Kel'momas. It always jarred a Kamian, realizing that so much of what he was, he, in fact, wasn't. Now he found himself terrified by the contrary realization, that more and more he was becoming what he wasn't, what he must never be, that he was becoming Seswatha. For so long, the sheer scale of the dreams had offered him an immunity of sorts. The things he dreamed simply didn't happen, at least not to the likes of him. With the Holy War, his life had taken a turn to the legendary, and the distance between his world and Seswatha's closed, at least in terms of what he witnessed. But even then, what he lived remained banal and impoverished. Seswatha never shat, the old mandate joke went. The dimensions of what a Kamian lived could always fall into the dimensions of what he dreamed, like a stone into a potter's urn. But now, riding as holy tutor at the warrior prophet's left hand? In a way, he was as much as Seswatha, if not more. In a way, he no longer shat either. And knowing this was enough to make him shit. Strangely enough, the dreams themselves had become more bearable. Taiwanre and Dagliash continued to predominate, though as always he couldn't fathom why they should follow this or any other rhythm of events. They were like swallows, swooping and circling in aimless patterns, sketching something almost, yet never quite, a language. He still woke, mouthing cries, but their force had been blunted somehow. At first, he attributed this to Esmanet, thinking each man had a certain allotment of torment, and that like wine in the bottom of a bowl, it could be tipped this way and that, but never increased. The problem was that painful days had never made for restful nights in the past. So he decided it had to be Kellis, and as with all realizations involving the warrior prophet, it seemed painfully obvious after the fact. Through Kellis, the scale of the present not only matched the scale of his dreams, it counterbalanced them with hope. Hope. Such a strange word. Did the consult know what they had created? How far could Golgotharoth see? Augury, Memgawa had written, said more about men's fear than about their future. But how could a Kamian resist? He slept with the first apocalypse. She was an old and taxing lover. How could he not daydream about the second, about the terrible power slumbering in Anasarimber Kellis and the overthrow of his school's ancient enemy? There would be glory this time. Victory would not come at the cost of all that mattered. Min Oroikus broken. Shoriatus, Makaratrig, Orang and Aurax, all of them destroyed. The no-god unresurrected. The consult a memory stamped into the muck. Despite their opiate glamour, there was something terrifying about these thoughts. The gods were perverse. Natter as they might, the priests knew nothing of their malicious whims. Perhaps they would see the world burn just to punish the hubris of one man. Nothing, a Kamian had long ago decided, was quite so dangerous as boredom in the absence of scruples. And Kellis, with his cryptic responses, only aggravated these apprehensions. Whenever a Kamian asked him why he continued to march on Shima when the Phanum were no more than a distraction, he always said, "If I'm to succeed my brother, I must reclaim his house." "But the war isn't here," a Kamian once exclaimed in exasperation. Kellis merely smiled, for it had become a kind of game at this point, and said, "But it must be, since the war is everywhere." Never had mystery seemed so taxing. "Tell me," Kellis said one night following their Gnostic lessons, "why is it the future that plagues you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Your questions always turn on what will happen, and very rarely on what I have already wrought." A Kamian shrugged, too weary to care much for anything beyond sleep. "Because I dream the future every night, I suppose. That, and I have the ear of a living prophet." Kellis laughed. "So, it's like hash and peaches," he said, repeating the off-color Nansor expression for irresistible combinations. "Even still, out of all of the men who dare ask me questions, You're entirely unique.
How so?
Most men ask after their souls.
A Commian could not speak. It seemed his heart could scarce beat, let alone his lungs breathe.
With me, Kellis continued, the tusk is rewritten, Akka.
A long, ransacking look.
Do you understand? Or do you simply prefer to think yourself damned?
Though he could muster no retort, Akamian knew. He preferred. During this period, he cast the Cants of Calling no fewer than 3 times, though he was only able to report to Nozera once. Apparently the old fool was having difficulty sleeping. The man was imperious and obsequious by turns, as though at once denying and recognizing the sudden shift in the balance of power between them. As a member of the Quorum, Nozera formally possessed absolute authority over Akamian. He could even command his execution if he thought the mission warranted such drastic measures. But in fact, the situation was quite the reverse. The consult had been rediscovered, and Anasarimber had returned, and the second apocalypse was nigh. These were the very things that gave their school meaning, the very mandate from which they derived their name, and for the moment, only one of their number, a discontent no less, secured their connection to them. During one peevish and heady moment of their discussion, Akamian realized that, in a sense, he had become their de facto Grand Master. Another unsettling parallel. As Akamian expected, the mandate was in an uproar. Their agents around the 3 Seas had been notified. The Quorum had organized an expedition that was set to leave for the Sacred Lands as soon as the Ocala winds began, a thought that filled Akamian with more than a little trepidation. But otherwise, they really had no idea as to how they should proceed. 2,000 years of preparation, it seemed, had left them utterly unprepared. And it showed in Nozera's relentless questions, which ranged from the asinine to the disconcertingly shrewd. How was it the Anasarimber could see the skin spies? Did he truly hail from Atrathau? Why did he continue marching against Chima? What had convinced Akamian of the man's divinity? How fared his old grudges? Whom did he serve? To this last, he answered, Seswatha, my brother. He understood Nozera's undertones well enough. The Quorum feared for his sanity. Though given his newfound preeminence, they had no doubt gilded their concerns in absolving explanations. Think of what the Red Whores did to him. Think of what he suffered. Akamian knew how it worked. Even now, they concocted rationales to relieve him of the burden they themselves coveted. Men forever argued their desires, forever made what the near-antique logicians called the inference to the purse, which they claimed had secured more conclusions for more men than mere truth ever could. As the Sarangi were fond of saying, if it jingled, then it was true. Despite his obvious suspicion, Nozera also voiced many ostensibly heartening sentiments.
We would have you know you're not alone in this, Akka. Your school stands with you.
Only to follow them with sentiments such as,
you've accomplished so much. Take pride, brother, take pride.
Which was to say, without saying, you've done enough. Then came the admonitions, which swiftly became recriminations. Beware the spires turned into, you were told to set aside your vengeance. In the space of breaths, take care in what you teach him became, many think you betray our school. When Akamian could tolerate no more, he finally said, the warrior prophet has asked me to relay a message to the Quorum, Nozera. Would you hear it? Akamian took the following silence for ethereal sputtering. They were powerless, and once again Nozera had been reminded.
Speak,
the old sorcerer finally replied. He says, you are players in this war. Nothing more. The balance remains precarious. Recall what it is you dream. Recall the ancient eras. Do not act out of conceit or ignorance. Another pause. Then,
that's it?
That is
what?
Does he imply that he possesses this war? Who is he compared with what we know, what we dream? All men were misers, Akamian reflected.
They differed only in the objects of their obsession. He, Nocera, is the warrior prophet.